He did it through people. And he didn't extinguish their personality. In other words, we don't understand that the inspiration of Scripture is just that God dictated it and Paul wrote it down, but rather he worked through his mind. He used the distinctives, and that's why Paul's writing is different than John's, because John's personality, John's education, who John is part of what God used. And that's one of the miracles. It's kind of like the miracle of incarnation, how God took on human flesh and that whole miracle of that was God and man. Well, the Scriptures come through people, men. It reflects their education. It reflects their language. It reflects their personality. And so, like I said, the Greek style of John, if you're studying first-year Greek, you like John because it's nice, simple language. The concepts are deep, but the language is rather ready. Luke, Hebrews, challenging Greek. Same Holy Spirit, all inspired Scripture, different authors, and it reflects that. And so we want to look at the instrument, that channel that God used to give us the book of Romans as we study the life of Paul. For the bigger picture, too, truly a mighty servant of the Lord. So the Apostle Paul looked like this. What do you notice about that picture, by the way? What do you see? One shoe off, one shoe on. I'm not sure why. Shoe has laces. He's got a sword. Yeah, you know, that's true often. You know, a lot of their things will not quite fit. But he's got a sword. And he's got books. Notice there's books over here. Here's another picture. Looking a little sterner there, a little older. But again, you see him with books in his hands. Here, by the way, the pen is in his right hand, which I think was probably more accurate. Did they had scrolls in particular. Were they of the book form yet? That's a good question. I know by the 4th century, okay, this is 1st century, by the 4th century they did have definitely books. That's right. That's right. So it must be. But it's interesting, you know, in Timothy he says, bring the scrolls. Bring the, you know. But, and notice again, a sword. Okay, why do we have Paul with a sword? Well, he wrote Ephesians, yeah. Sword of the Spirit, maybe. He was, you know, he was really like a warrior. Sometimes he's called the Lion of God, like a warrior of God. Maybe at this time in Rome, they had an open carry law, and so he was. By the way, that sword also looks not quite period appropriate, right? So a good term for that, it's anachronistic. Anachronistic, or we could say it doesn't fit the time frame. But there's another picture. So let's look at an overview quickly of his life. Dates. Actually, I think I would change that to AD 67. But we can gather that he was born around that first decade of the millennium. So how does that compare to the age of Jesus? Maybe about 10 years younger, because Jesus is born from 4 to 6 B.C., but pretty much contemporaries. He wrote 13 to 14 books of the New Testament. What's the problem? Why can't I figure out how many books Jesus... Yeah, Hebrews. Many, many, many good scholars, especially older scholars, say it was Paul that wrote Hebrews. And then after that, there's a plethora of options. He wrote 13 to 14 books of the New Testament. That's a lot of the text. What's really interesting is Luke wrote a lot of the Scripture of the New Testament. And Luke and Paul were close companions, and so if you think about it, Paul's influence on the New Testament is vast. Yes. Yeah. I mean, because he's still a young man when he died. No, so, or at least I would like to say so. He was, let's say AD 67 looks like the year of his execution. Let's say he's born, let's say 5 AD, so he's 62-ish. He's late 50s to early 60s when he dies. Why does he look so old? He calls himself Paul the Aged. Now, one thing, remember, you know, have you heard the expression the 80 is the new 70 or something? No, it's people are living a little bit longer in our current time frame. He had a very hard life, but maybe some people just want to put him as a very old man. Now, John was really old, but Paul was still what we might consider in the prime of life. Remember, he didn't die from old age. He died from execution. So that kind of helps you think. Maybe those pictures, like especially this earlier one, he doesn't look, you know, he could be just kind of blonde there. Here, he doesn't look like 62, does he? Yes. Yeah, it kind of looks like a Moses or, yeah. Yep. Yeah. True. Here's just a quick overview of some of his New Testament travels. Wayne, were you going to say something? Yeah. Yeah, he had more, and he was lost at sea. He was traveling a lot in all kinds of weather conditions. So yeah, he probably did have a more weathered look to him. True. He's born in Tarsus. He eventually comes to Jerusalem for education. He heads to Damascus. Remember, that's where he's converted. Just to kind of show you some of his travels. After Damascus, after his conversion, he goes to Arabia for a while and ministers in Arabia and Damascus, visits in Jerusalem, and this is kind of just quick overview. Goes back to Tarsus. And I realize sometimes I misstate, and I'll tell you now, I probably will say Tarshish at some point. Where's Tarshish? Turkey, or closer towards Spain. But Tarshish is where, remember, Jonah would try to go. But this is Tarsus. Spent a lot of time in Antioch, the church there, Asia Minor. He did evangelism, then Europe, Caesarea. Spent a couple of years in prison. That's one of the things about going back to Israel. It's kind of amazing. We can see, you know, the palace that would have been where he was in prison for 2 years. It's kind of just a stunning thing to walk around and think, this is where Paul was. There's the theater he must have seen, and perhaps was in at some point. After his release, very likely, because he did do, his goal was to reach Spain. After his release, he did travel for a couple of years. And there's an early and strong tradition among the Waldensians that indeed he established a witness for Christ in Spain. Question, you know, I can't be emphatic. But then back to Rome and then heaven. But just gives you, he was all over the place in a rather short time when a lot of the travel was done by foot. You know, we're kind of used to the idea that you can travel a lot of miles pretty quickly. But when you think of back and forth by foot and by boat, amazing. Let's talk about the fact that he was born in Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus, he's called at times. He'll mention in various places in Acts that he was from Tarsus. Remember, when he's questioned about his citizenship, he says, "I'm a citizen of Tarsus." You know. I'm a citizen from Tarsus. Where is Tarsus? It's it's the capital of the province of Cilicia, which at that time was Cilicia and Syria together. And it's in the southeast of Asia Minor. I'll show you a map in just a little bit. It was also the center of large transport trade. So, you know, it was on a major road, about, I think, 10 miles from the coast. So very significant hub of transport. Tarsus was the depot to which the products of these countries from all over were brought and distributed east to west. And so it was a wealthy city. So there was a lot of wealth in Tarsus and a lot of commerce in Tarsus. The town had an extensive trade in timber and also had an extensive trade in the long, fine hair of goats that were in the thousands in nearby herds. Why is that important? I think the hair of these goats was called silicium, and they made garments and tarps and tents out of the hair of these goats. Why is that important for us? Paul's a tent maker, and so that's a natural trade coming from this. By the way, we would gather from what he says of himself that, you know, that he, remember, he tells a Roman, when he says, "You're a citizen?" And he said, "I paid a great price for that." And Paul says, "Well, I was born a citizen." What that means is, you know, his father, grandfather, first of all, you had to have a certain amount of substance, of monetary substance. So he was came from a well-to-do family. But they probably had also helped a Roman leader at some time who granted them that. So he has a heritage of being in good favor with Rome. Some have suggested, you know, if you could make tents, often the military needs tents. And so if you maybe provided tents and that kind of stuff for a military campaign, you might have been rewarded with Roman citizenship. But so in other words, he comes from an established, prosperous, and secure family, we would gather. About any questions, comments, could jump in. F.F. Bruce, a British scholar, describes and says, Tarsus, in short, was what we might call a university city. I read one Scottish commentator and said, like our Glasgow, which is from which he was writing, it was a university town. Maybe some of you who have grown up in a university-type city or been around one, you know, they have a certain flavor. It kind of permeates everything. And often, if there's a college or something nearby, it's just kind of... It just seems that the conversation reflects what's going on. You know, and why that's important is I think just being there, he would have become familiar with some of the Greek philosophy discussions. You know, you just hear people talking about things. It's like, you know, when I'll go to a conference or something, one of the benefits is just being there, hearing people talk about things raises your level of awareness. Just by Jim Mook calls it just the benefit of osmosis. You just go to these conferences. You don't even have to read papers. You just, being there, you hear it. It just kind of absorbs information. So that probably influenced some of his awareness of Greek studies at the time. When I was thinking about that, I was thinking one time when I was with some friends, we were cramming for a chemistry exam. I hate to confess, but sometimes we crammed. We didn't, you know, you're supposed to study, you know, several hours a day all semester. But there we were cramming for an exam and just talking back and forth. And the guy waiting, we were at a pizza place, and the guy came up and, you know, was, I guess, bringing us, getting our order or something like this. And he said, so you guys studying chemistry? And we said, yep, we are. Have an exam coming up tomorrow. Oh, he says, well, let me give you some advice, he said. If you're going to be serious about chemistry, you need a PhD. Don't stop with a master's. We're like, what? He said, well, I've got a master's, he said. So if you're going, if you want to make a career in chemistry, you're not going to do it with just a master's degree. And I think so. You know, so he could just, our pizza guy was just as he was there. You know, he absorbed what we were talking about. Knew. So you see what I'm saying? In a university town, and Tarsus was known not for as many internationals that came to it, but it was a prominent university, mostly of people from Tarsus area. And so that tends to just, it's in the air. That becomes significant for Paul's awareness of the Greek culture. Matter of fact, an ancient historian, in terms of university and learning of the community, ranked Tarsus right up there with Alexandria. You've heard of the Library of Alexandria and Athens, the center of philosophy. I think it was Strabo that made that comment. And so, I mean, this is... Tarsus was very much on the academic map. Here's just a map of Paul's journeys. We're going to go over this with time, but there you can see the Mediterranean Sea, and Israel is far to the east over there. Just a little area. But Tarsus, well, Paul says this in Acts 21:39. Paul said, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city." No, it was highly respected, and he knew that. And so here's where Tarsus is. That arrow is right on Tarsus. So you can see it's a little bit from the coast, but what a central, you can just imagine, you could just see between sea traffic and roads. That was just a very significant, prominent place, pretty close to Syrian Antioch, which was also a major, would be in the top four or five cities of the ancient world. That would be Turkey now. So, you get the picture of where he was from. Now, before I leave that, tell me why that would influence who Paul is. What do you know about Paul beyond the facts I've told you? What were the things you might think about him? I haven't told you that, but we will get there. But that wasn't in Tarsus. A couple things I get from him being in Tarsus like this. One, later on he will quote Greek philosophers. How did he get that? He was there in Tarsus and heard people talking about it. His Greek is excellent. So he knows market. He writes marketplace Greek, Koine Greek, but he's clearly a Greek speaker. He's a big city guy. What kind of places did Paul minister to? Cities. Matter of fact, when he writes the book of Romans, he's saying, "I'm so eager what God is doing among you. I'm so excited for what God is doing among you, and I can't. It has been on my bucket list," he says. That's in the Greek. It's on my bucket list to get to Rome. You know, he had, in his strategy, he would go to the major cities. Some people kept away from the major cities. Matter of fact, compare him to the disciples of Jesus. Fishermen up in Galilee. And though there were some, Capernaum was a significant port on the Galilean Sea, Jerusalem was, in a sense, the big city, or Caesarea. I guess there was Caesarea Philippi north of there, where Jesus, who men say that I am, there's some incredible ruins there. There's some significant cities, but those guys were more small-town fishermen. Paul was comfortable right in the middle of a large, thoroughly Gentile city. And so that fits with who he is and how God is going to take him and send him to the Greek world, because he grew up in one of the major hubs of the Greek world. And again, if you look at that map, right in the hub of a very significant area. But he also calls himself a Hebrew of Hebrews, yes. A little more cosmopolitan in his background, where he didn't feel quite the fish out of water. In some of the context. I think you're right. And again, even in a place like Tarsus, even in a place like Rome, the citizens were a minority. And so that was, you could pull out, and he does very significantly pull out the citizenship card at times. And it's kind of like when I was in Nepal, in the old days, being from the United States was a thing that brought certain respect, and in many parts of the world that's not true today. But I loved being in Nepal, because as a foreigner, that made you stand out in a good way. Matter of fact, when we were driving along, and I was sitting, in the front next to whoever was driving me over to the school or whatever, and what was really funny is there were no stop signs except in the very heart of downtown Kathmandu. But where we drove, we didn't see. It was just everybody just kind of went to the intersection and got through it. Sometimes there were traffic cops, though. When they saw a foreigner, it was instant right of way. And so it was nice having me in the next to the driver in the front seat, because all of a sudden it seemed like we always got first shot for the intersection. And because I was, and so that, in the same way, a Roman citizenship, that stands out in the Roman world. And so when he tells that Roman official, well, I'm a citizen. You're a citizen. I paid a lot of money for that. I was born a citizen. So he didn't flaunt it, but he knew when to pull out the citizenship card for the purposes of God's glory. A big city is where he's from. Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting there. Matter of fact, in Philippians chapter 3, where are you guys, the teens, the high schoolers? Where are they, you in Philippians? Starting 3? Oh, then I won't do anything with this. Never mind. I'll just make a couple of quick comments. And if you want to know more about Philippians 3, go to the high school class. Paul in chapter 3 says, finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same thing is no trouble to me. It's a safeguard for you. He says, watch out for the false teachers. In verse 4, although I myself might have confidence even in the flesh, if anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more. He says, you want credentials? I've got credentials. Circumcised the eighth day of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. So he says, you know, you want religiosity? I had it. You want credentials? He says, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews. What does he mean by that? Circumcised the eighth day, so in other words, devout, practicing family of the stock of Israel, a true Jew. They often didn't use the term Jew because that actually referred just to the tribe of Judah, but a stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin. I mean, he could actually name, even though Israel's been with, he knew he was a tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews concerning the law, Pharisee, he said. So he's a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin. He calls himself a Hebrew of the Hebrews. That doesn't just mean he's a Jew, because he's already told us that. What he means by that, he was raised as a Hebrew speaker, maybe Aramaic speaker. Now, what town did he grow up in? What would we expect the mother tongue of Tarsus to be at that time? Greek. He says, in my home, we were Hebrew speakers. Now, if you go to Jerusalem, you expect that. Tarsus? What that means is they were so devout, they kept their mother tongue there in Tarsus. At least, you know, his father may have come over from Israel, maybe a grandfather. However many generations he was there, he was raised speaking Hebrew. So he knew his Hebrew scriptures phenomenally well. He'll go later and get trained in Jerusalem. We'll talk about that. But this tells me something. And so can you imagine someone growing up in Dallas, born in Dallas, and yet their mother tongue isn't Texan? Maybe their mother tongue is German or French or something. You know, in other words, so you know what that kind of reminds me of? The Amish people. You know, their mother tongue isn't English. And so it's kind of fun when you meet them. Here they are, born and bred Pennsylvanians, and yet they've got an accent because English isn't their first language. So they maintain their religion and their identity in the midst of a culture all around them. That's how Paul lived. Such a devout Jew that even in Tarsus, he was still a Hebrew. He was a Hebrew speaker. And like if you look at Acts chapter 6, verse 1, there's a distinction between Hellenist Jews, Greek-speaking Jews, and Hebrew Jews. So the Jerusalem Jews, Hebrew speakers. Those who had grown up in places like New York were Greek speakers. New York wasn't there yet, okay? Pay attention. But Tarsus, we would expect him to be a Greek speaker. No, he was a Hebrew of Hebrews. A Hebrew of Hebrews. In other words, his parents were Hebrews. So he was raised in a Hebrew home while in Tarsus. He was no... What that means is they were studious in not embracing the Greek pagan culture around them. Because a lot of Jews, they call that assimilation. Modern Jews today talk about the problem of assimilation when Jews start acting like Gentiles. He didn't. So he could live in a Greek culture, be familiar with Greek language and conversation, but he didn't embrace it. He kept himself apart from the Gentiles. Matter of fact, he knew full well, as a good Hebrew of Hebrews, strict Pharisee, he'll even tell us, he wouldn't even eat a meal with a Gentile. He wouldn't, you know, they didn't like going into Gentile homes because you might get defiled. So the fact that he could live that way all his life until he became a Christian, how amazing. God calls him to what kind of people? Gentiles. So the rest of his life, he is sitting down with Gentiles to eat in Gentile homes. Isn't that amazing? Yes. He was very what? Yeah. And so that's the whole point. He had to make a dramatic change. Education. So I'd say he's likely insulated from Gentile education and was taught in a synagogue school. So he was a Hebrew of Hebrews. So he didn't go to any kind of Gentile education. So some have suggested he went to university in Tarsus. I doubt it. Because we know later he ends up in Jerusalem. So he would have been taught in the synagogue school, just kind of an isolated, insulated Jewish boy in Tarsus. We're told he was also that he was educated by under Gamaliel in Jerusalem. That would have been from his early teens. So we're probably talking 13 to 15, 12 to 15, somewhere in there, his father would have sent him to Jerusalem. Again, showing his, you know, how devout he was. You know, he's sending his son off to be educated there. And here's what he said in Acts 2:22-23. I'm indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. He's talking to the crowd in Jerusalem. But he's saying, yeah, I'm from Tarsus, but I'm trained under Gamaliel, who was considered the beauty of the law. I mean, Gamaliel was thought so highly of. Well, let's look at who he was. Talk a little bit about his training. He was a Pharisee. So they were legalistic, very, and the word Pharisee means separated. They separated themselves from all kinds of influences. They believed in the Bible, and so they believed in the supernatural and resurrection, all that, unlike Sadducees, but they also added to it all the rabbinic traditions as equal to the Bible. They knew me from the first that if they were willing to testify according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. So he says, I was not only a Hebrew of Hebrews, I was a very strict Pharisee. In Israel, there were about 6,000 Pharisees, and he was of the most strictest flavor. But he was familiar with Greek literature. He quotes it at times because he was raised in University City, but also Gamaliel, his teacher, showed familiarity with Greek literature. And so now I do want to talk about Gamaliel. Here's a statement. He was had in reputation among all the people, Acts 5:34 says, he was of the class to whom Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus belonged, a man thoroughly religious, thoroughly a Jew, thoroughly on principle a Pharisee. So Gamaliel was highly respected. Matter of fact, I quote him in the Seder service. So he's actually in the Seder service quoted. Highly respected. He was distinguished above most of his countrymen by his attainments in Greek learning. Where did Paul get that? He grew up in the city. But Gamaliel could help him to think about Greek philosophy compared to biblical revelation. So he was well educated in those things under Gamaliel. That's the end of my slideshow. What else can I tell you about that? Well, Gamaliel, like I said, was highly respected, highly esteemed. And so what he's saying is, I studied under the most respected professor of Judaism here in the town of Judaism. I was raised in a devout Jewish family, so devout that they kept the homeland language as our home language. And so he was a thoroughly, he was a big city boy, highly educated, and the very best Hebrew and Jewish training. Very devout. He wasn't going to be in any way compromising with the Gentiles around him. He was thoroughly educated in Scripture and the rabbinic thinking and familiar with Greek philosophy. And God's going to use him mightily. He's equipped in a huge way for the calling God has for him. So he's born about AD 5 to 10. We get that because he'll talk about himself being young at one point and Paul the aged. And so some of those tell us parameters of when he was. So if he's born AD 5, he's about 10 years younger than Jesus. What's interesting to me is some suggest rabbis who trained like he was at that time would often, after they finished their education, they'd be sent off to go work, you know, teach in synagogues for a while, get their feet wet. We're not told that about Paul. We see him very instrumental in what's going on, maybe even being a member of the Sanhedrin. Gamaliel was. But he was the right-hand man of the Sanhedrin leaders, the Jewish leaders of Jerusalem. So he was a man of great influence, and I think he may have been just staying in Jerusalem from his teens right through. If that's the case, the Sanhedrin is right there in the temple precincts. He could have been in town when Jesus cleansed the temple first or second time. He might have been in town when Jesus was crucified. He certainly knew all about what Jesus was about. And the fascinating thing is, and he hated everything about Jesus. That's as far as we're going to go tonight. A big city, sophisticated, educated, devout, top-flight Pharisee. And God's going to use all of that in his training. And it really comes out supremely in the book of Romans. David. Well, Jesus, you know, of course, was... I'm probably going to go with a date of AD 33. There's two possible dates for Jesus' crucifixion, burial, resurrection, ascension. AD 30 or AD 33. You can get good scholars on both sides of it, but one of those two. If we go for 33, Jesus was about 37, 38 years old. Remember they said, you're about 30. But he would have been in the upper 30s, which means that Paul would have been in the upper 20s. Maybe young 30 when all that was happening. But again, if you are the disciple of a great professor, then that means you're party to, you know, you're hearing all that's going on. And so he probably heard about the Sanhedrin trial. He may have heard about rumors about this guy, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. You know, he may have heard about what Jesus claimed and taught. The conflicts between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. What do we, you know, he did miracles. There are no such things as miracles. Well, there are miracles. He must be a sorcerer is what the Pharisees ended up kind of saying. So all of that stuff, he would have been, as a young adult, very conversant with all of that. Yeah, named after the Benjamite king. Yeah. I'm sure that was significant. Of course, it could have been a family name, but not unlike, you know, kind of significant when you name someone after the king of your tribe, the one king of your tribe. That could have been so something of their spirit. How do we understand the fact he's called Saul and Paul? Very likely growing up, and especially being a Roman citizen, he would have had a Gentile name. If you know some Jewish friends, you might find that they will have a Gentile name and a Hebrew name. Matter of fact, in Israel, that would kind of confuse the teachers there. What do you mean, you know, on your school records, your name is this, and you go by that. Why is that? You know, because in other words, they have their Hebrew name and their... And at my Chinese friends, the same thing. They might have a name like Tom. Well, that's not their name. They go by, you know, they actually have something else. Or maybe you have a friend from India, and they won't even tell you what their name is because they say you couldn't understand it anyway. So I'll just, you call me Bob. Okay, Bob. And so in the same way, it would be common for, it was not uncommon at all for him to have a name like Paul as a Roman and Shaul as a Hebrew. Of course, what did his parents call him? Shaul. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, that's getting us started to start thinking about who this man is. But so many have commented, you know, he was a giant of a man. And when I think of history, there are periods when there were giants in the land. You know, I think of, for example, in the founding days of our country, you know, in the days of independence. I mean, there were some giants. These guys were just amazing in terms of their breadth of learning, strength of character, vision and understanding of the big picture. There were giants in the days. I look at the times of the Reformation. And it's remarkable to me that you had guys like a Melanchthon, kind of ignored because he's in the shadow of the others. But, you know, you look at Zwingli and Melanchthon, but you look at Calvin and Luther and Knox and some of these giants that were in the land. You know, and it's amazing they were some contemporaries. There are periods in history where God raises up some amazing giants. Paul is right there in top flight. And that's what's interesting to me. Even secular scholars recognize he was one of the incredible thinkers of history. And I'm going to guess that more books have been written analyzing the book of Romans than probably any other book in history. And so it's going to be kind of exciting to see how God uses him.